This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And from parrots to ferrets, we're here to help you bring out the best in your pet's behavior. So if you have a question for us, love to hear from you. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll be exploring another special topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
Well, we're going to talk about giraffes today. You know, those amazing, almost prehistoric-looking animals.
Yeah.
They're huge, for one thing. They, you know, they can get to up to 15 feet tall.
All neck.
That's tall, Larry. But we're not going to look at their necks so much. We're going to look at the social bonds between them.
They go out for pizza, watch surfer movies, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. We'll be talking about that.
And a little bit more, I'll bet, too. And we'll also welcome a guest to talk about his thrilling but sometimes dangerous search for rare wildlife on all 7 continents. We'll find out what he saw and why he did it in the first place a little later on in the show. But first, let's take some calls. And here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Keenan White, calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Keenan, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
I have an adorable new puppy. Her name's Dixie. And Dixie has no bad habits except for one, and Dixie digs to the point where my yard looks like a minefield. I don't know what to do. I've heard a few odd suggestions, and I thought I'd call some experts.
Well, I'm curious. Tell us about your odd suggestions.
Well, it's the only one that I've really heard, other than sort of putting her nose back in the hole and giving her a swat in the butt, is filling the holes with poop. And I thought, you know, I've got so many holes I'd have to ask for donations, plus I'm not really keen on filling the holes with poop, so I'm hoping you can help us.
Well, we could put it out on the website, you know, please send Keenan some
bunch
more
poop,
yeah. But there's some good news here. There are some much more enjoyable ways to work around this. One of the things to think about, though, is why your dog is digging and when your dog is digging. If your dog is loose for long periods of time in hot weather out in the yard, a lot of dogs are going to dig because they're digging for cool earth. So I don't know if this happens more in summer than it does in winter. Is that a possibility?
No. I have a few other dogs, and they do the same thing. They'll dig their hole, and they'll keep it all summer just as their cool spot. She is a mystery digger. She is outside a lot. But literally, I can go outside, and there will be 4 new holes in the yard. And she looks at me, and that little snout's just covered with dirt. And somebody said maybe she's just bored, and I can't imagine that she's bored in the yard. Now, my problem is this. We don't have anything but garden. We have completely dug up our yard, so we are gardeners. It is our passion.
Yeah, gotcha.
And she is all over the garden.
It does sound like every individual being different, you know, she just loves to dig, and some dogs seem to love it more than others. She might be going after little critters or, you know, even earthworms or something. She just might just love to dig. Who knows? So I would suggest that you fight fire with fire by giving her a designated digging area, DDA.
All right. Okay.
You want to dig it up so it's loose. You want to put a little sand in it. And what I want you to do is half bury something she really loves in there. You can even get real bones if they're not going to be competition and problems with other dogs.
Huh. Okay.
And you're going to take her over there, and I want you to dig. And she might not dig while you're digging, actually. This is a wonderful opportunity.
Get down on your hands and knees.
This is a great opportunity to feel somewhat foolish, which is my belief dogs are actually put on earth to make us feel foolish and put us in our place where we belong. But so you dig, 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 good girl, good girl. And if she digs, you say, good girl, good girl. Now, meanwhile, she's still going to want to dig other places. So meanwhile, what you do need to do is make the rest of the yard either inaccessible for a while until she gets in the right habit, she gets older, or make it logistically unpleasant for her. You can spray sprays that dogs don't like. Citronella is a spray a lot of dogs don't like.
Okay.
But let her dig. Just let her dig in the designated digging area. I sound like the military, the DDA.
All right, and good luck to you. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia, we heard from Tim in Norfolk, Virginia, and he has this question for you. My partner and I recently got a male Cocker Spaniel that's a year and a half old. We're not a big fan of the name the previous owner gave him. He was named by one of their small children. What's the best way to rename this dog and train him to respond to his new name?
You know, it's easy. It's really easy. It depends on the dog. It can take a couple of weeks to maybe even a couple of months. But all you need to do, it's so easy. You just arm yourself with something wonderful, usually little, really wonderful little treats or toys or all of the above. And all you need to do is you just say the name, pick the new name. Be sure that the new name doesn't sound like another,
the old one
or another one of your cues. And it's fine if it sounds like the old one. That's okay. But don't make the mistake I made, which is naming your dog Tay when your correction is Hey. You'd think I would have known, right? But no, didn't take very long for me to go, okay, that's not going to work. So thus Pippi Tay, who used to be Tay. So all you need to do is, let's say you're going to change it to Chuck.
Okay. Or Larry.
Or Larry. Let's do Larry.
Larry.
Let's do Larry. So you say, Larry. And if Larry turns his head around, you toss him a little treat or you throw his ball. And do that 5 times in a row. And just all during the day, have something that Larry really wants. And if you say, Larry, and Larry doesn't turn around, I'm not going to keep repeating it. Larry. Larry, Larry, no. in the time-honored way of human primates, because that's not going to help. What I am going to do, say I say Larry and your dog doesn't turn around, then I want you to use what are called prompts and do something that gets him to turn around so you can reinforce it. So you go, or do something that gets Larry to turn his head around. Good boy, and then toss him a treat. Just be careful, though, if you use prompts too much, you get a dog who responds to
the prompt. Hey.
Right. So.
Come on over here.
Right. Right. My dog's name is
Clap.
Right. That's like that joke, you know, my dog, my name, that the dog talking is all, my name is no bad dog. Anyway, so it, you know, it can take a couple of weeks. It can maybe take 2 months, but it's not hard at all.
And thanks for that question. And how do people send in their questions?
Oh, we love to hear your questions and your ideas. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And you can call us if you want to talk with us in person at 1-800-462-7413. Matter of fact, we have somebody online. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Nancy. I'm calling from Kensington, Maryland.
Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling about my cat. She's 7.5 years old, and she's bored. She's very playful, and I've done everything I can think of. I even at one point, I went and got a bird feeder, and I live on the 5th floor, so I hooked it up. It took me all day, and she loved it. It was absolutely, I thought, oh, thank God, this is the answer. But then the landlord made me take it down.
Oh, no. Well, Nancy, let me ask you a question. What is she doing that makes you say she's bored? Tell us about the behavior that's problematic.
Okay. The minute I get in the house, I mean, she's just clinging to me, and she wants to play nonstop. Mm. I mean, and I designated playtime for her. I have so many toys, I can't tell you. I mean, I only have a 2.5-room apartment, so, I mean, it looks like a gym here for kitties.
Just so much you can do, right?
Yeah.
Is there a possibility that we could also describe your cat as demanding?
Yeah.
I'm getting a picture here. So if she stopped constantly trying to get you to play with her, would that make life a little nicer?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. There are a couple of things I would do. One, I would invest in, and you may have some already, but I would go out of my way to find some more toys that are the kind of toys that are interactive with her, such that she and the toy are happy to play together. And a lot of times the best ones that sort of fit that bill are toys that have food buried inside. So she has to work to get the food. So basically, rather than being outside spending her time and her energy hunting, we can create a situation in which she needs to actually work for her own dinner. So rather than eating food out of a bowl, there are toys you can get where you basically stuff food inside, some kind of a little, it's almost like a little puzzle-like device. So I would go online, I would go to big pet stores, and I would basically look for toys like that. The other thing I would do is I want you to start gradually changing the rules such that you just decide there's a certain period of time and do it the same time every day. And you know best. You know the best time for you. Where this is just Nancy time. This is just Nancy time. And you're not going to respond to her. And so she comes up and she demands to play with you. You're not going to respond to her. You're just going to go in another room. Mm-hmm. You could even teach her to just like you put a dog in a crate. There's no reason you can't do that with a cat. Cats, of course, would not agree with that. But you could basically have a little kitty crate that's very comfy. You know, it's a wonderful little place. You can put kitty nip in there, which is basically drugs for cats. You know? And you can just say, you know, from 8 to 9, it's my time. It's Nancy time. Because I think it will be good for this cat to learn that there's some boundaries and to learn to self-inhibit herself.
Yep. So good luck, and thank you very much for calling. And by the way, here's something else. Michelle from Arcata, California, wrote in to tell us what kept her cat entertained.
Oh, good.
She says she discovered that her cat's favorite toy is the cardboard roll left over after a toilet paper is used up.
Right.
That little,
the really expensive toys out there, yeah.
Michelle tears up one edge of the roll to give the cat a start, and then the cat takes over. She kicks at it, bites it, tosses it in the air, sends it flying across the floor. She will always choose her toilet paper over store-bought toys.
The only problem with that is that I have known cats who started playing with those little rolls.
Yep.
And so what they started doing was taking the full roll down out of the bathroom and getting all the paper off so they could
play with the roll.
But I love, you know, it's so, it's like kids, you know, they play with the package as much as they do with a toy inside. My cat's favorite is a paper bag from the grocery. That's Sushi's favorite. So great advice. Keep it up.
And if somebody wants to send us a pet tip, how do they do that?
We'd love to hear from you. It's easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join us, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll take a closer look at the social bonds between giraffes and why they matter. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time to take a look at this week's topic. And Tricia, you have some news to share about giraffes.
That's right, I do. You know, there was a study by Bashaw and some colleagues at the San Diego Zoo that looked at 6 captive adult female giraffes. And there was a varying number of juveniles and adult males in there, but this is a relatively captive group. But what they were looking for was evidence of social bonds, because historically it's been believed that there weren't very many social bonds at all, that giraffes were basically pretty much asocial. Well, the researchers found evidence of some very strong social bonds between some of the females.
Why did they once think that giraffes didn't form social relationships? You know, most animals, types of animals, seem to.
Well, especially the ones that we like to pay attention to.
Right.
You know, it's certainly true. But, you know, it's understandable, because if you looked at groups of giraffes, previous observations, and I found the same thing myself when I was in Africa, you found you couldn't ever predict what females would be together at any given time. So it's not like a band of horses where you would, you know, find all 7 females were the same every time. So basically, one day you'd see three giraffes, and one would be Martha and Virginia and Chloe. You know, but the next day, then you'd find Martha and Judy together, and Chloe with somebody else, and or you'd find Martha off by herself, or maybe with her young, you know, her young son or daughter. You could just never predict who was going to be with who.
Okay, so if that's not the case, what's their social system really like then?
Well, here's what might be happening. There's a kind of a social system called a fission or fusion social system, and it's actually the kind of social system that chimpanzees have, in which they form subgroups, and they vary tremendously from day to day, but that doesn't mean the social bonds between them aren't really strong. It's sort of like, if you make a human analogy, it's like a group of teenagers, you know, five of them will go together to a movie one night, and then mm-hmm. two of that group will get together with some other kids and go shopping at the mall the next day. You know?
Yeah.
But so there's still, you might be best friends with somebody, but it doesn't necessarily mean you spend all of your time with
her. I play softball one night a week with one group, and I play golf another night of the week with a different group.
Exactly.
And we're all good friends.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe humans have sort of a fission or fusion kind of way. No, we sort of like chimpanzees as our closest relatives, right?
Well, why is it so important to know this?
You know, even though giraffes aren't endangered, their wild populations, they're still at risk. There's so many factors that are sort of working against animals as big and you know, obvious as giraffes. It's not like giraffes can hide, right? You know? So anything we can learn about their behavior and their ecology we could possibly use to keep their populations healthy. And, you know, I think we have to start thinking about their social bonds when we make decisions about dividing up groups, sending one individual from one zoo to another zoo. You know, that happens relatively commonly. And I think this is happening is that we're starting to think about social relationships as well as sort of physical health and housing as another important aspect when you're talking about animal welfare.
It's an interesting study. And if you want to learn more about it, we have some links available online at www.callingallpets.org. And we can take some more calls, too, at 1-800-462-7413. And let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Marilyn in Tallahassee.
Tallahassee, Florida, I'll bet. Marilyn, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I just needed some advice. I have a very dear cat who just had her first litter of kittens. And she lost two of her babies through a heart problem and has one remaining baby that seems to be thriving quite well. That baby is about 8 weeks old and is quite ambitious and happy. However, the mother cat won't let the baby out from underneath our bed or stray at all from the bedroom.
Ooh.
And she occasionally will go into the closet where the kittens were originally born and softly cry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if she was missing her other two babies and perhaps is being overprotective with the remaining baby. But we can't seem to get her to let the baby grow up and kind of explore more outside of the bedroom. Right now, she's got a firm grip on her. What can we do?
Well, I'm really glad you're calling because I agree with you that this is not a normal course of development, and
no.
it could create some problems later
mm-hmm.
on. So one of the things I would do is I would pick up Mom and I would take her somewhere else, and I would put her somewhere where hopefully she would not be too distressed about leaving her baby. Maybe she'd be, I don't know, maybe her concerns would be assuaged by a can of tuna fish or something.
Okay.
You know? Basically, put her somewhere else, hopefully where she's not all distressed and meowing for her baby, try and find mm-hmm. the best food or something you possibly can. You might even want to use that spray pheromone feel away. Spray it in a little room you're going to put her in, make a really comfy bed, spray the feel away in the room. There's even a little plug-in you could use. That might help. It might not. Can't hurt to try. And then the kitten at 8 weeks is absolutely old enough to be off on her own, exploring the bedroom, exploring other areas, you know, playing with you. So I think that would be a very important thing to do. Have you tried doing that, by the way?
We have tried taking Mom away for a short period of time, but she does get quite upset.
Mm.
In fact, she is just now allowing the baby even access to eating dry food.
You're going to need to start taking mom away when you feed the kitten, because the kitten definitely needs to start getting onto
right.
Non-milk, you know, food. And, yeah, that's not good for mom. So, yeah, I would start, hopefully, given that the kitten is 8 weeks, this would be a normal time where the mom would start working on weaning the kitten. So time might be on your side. You also, if things don't go well, you might want to talk to your veterinarian about whether there's any possibility of suppressing some of the lactation hormones like prolactin and oxytocin, I know, or highly related, correlated
yeah.
with lactation. And so if some of those hormones backed off a little bit, that might help things along too.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Marilyn. Appreciate your call. Tricia, I looked at the newspaper this week. In fact, every day I look through it, and we came across a story of a 22-year-old man in nearby Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, I thought I'd ask you about. According to a Fond du Lac police report, the man went into a local hospital last week to be treated for scratches to the face and
yeah.
arms. He told police that he was reaching for a ringing telephone when his calico cat clawed him, attempting to bite the back of his head even.
Oh, no.
Family members who live with a cat say the cat is affectionate and sits on people's laps until the phone rings, including cell phones, and that's when it becomes aggressive. We've had calls before about dogs barking when the phone rings.
But we have.
What's up with a cat?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know exactly, but I'll tell you, it is not uncommon. You know, I've been working with behavior problems for about 20 years, and I have seen both dogs and cats. I've yet to have a horse who goes through the window and attacks somebody when the phone rings, I'm happy to say. But it's obviously is relatively rare, but nonetheless, there's something about that noise that sets some animals off. And I honestly don't know why. Is it the noise itself that the animal finds aversive? Or for some reason, is it some kind of Pavlovian conditioning where that noise has been related to some kind of internal emotional state, which is what classical conditioning actually is? And so that sort of triggers an area in the amygdala, which is the center of rage, a very primitive area of the brain of all mammals. And if you stimulate the right part, the animal basically becomes very aggressive and goes into a kind of a rage. And so you can stimulate that sometimes sort of indirectly by some particular kind of stimulus. So exactly why is the cat reacting this way? I don't know. But I can tell you what I do about it. I would start counter classical conditioning in that I would create a very soft, barely discernible version. So you might want to have friends call and have blankets over the phone, turn the ringer way down, put blankets over the phone. In some way, create that sound, but at very, very low level. And then every time the cat hears the sound, something the cat loves happens. And so the best thing is always food, because you can give lots of it in little small quantities. You can use really good healthy food. And then set up situations where over and over and over again that noise occurs, but at a very, very low level, and then gradually increase the sound.
Well, I hope you were not attacked by a cat
right,
as you listen to the two of us talk here. And if you'd like to join us, you could call it at 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're at Calling All Pets.
This is Lola Abshire in Boise, Idaho.
Lola, what's up with you?
Well, I have a black lab. He's about 10 years old, I think. He was a found dog. He found me about 2.5 years ago. And having a past history, I have found he has some interesting behaviors, and he's been pretty entertaining. But I've always wished he could talk so I could ask him about his past life.
Oh, really? I know just what you mean.
But he has started doing something over the last year that is pretty perplexing, and he doesn't do it on a regular basis, but he'll go into my bedroom, and he will pull the covers back, and sometimes he just pulls back the comforter, and sometimes he pulls back that as well as the sheet, and sometimes just off the pillow, and sometimes just down to the bottom sheet, and then lay there. And it's not like he goes up and romps around on the bed and it gets unmade or anything. He's quite deliberate and very tidy about it.
So the question is, when he's done, does he make it? Does he build them back up?
Darn it, he always forgets that part of it.
So. Well, this is where the training comes in.
Yeah, train him to do that.
You know, there's actually, just as a side note, there's actually a trick in the tricks class of Dog's Best Friend here in Madison, Wisconsin, in which it's called Go to Bed. And the dog, you put a blanket down on the piece. You could teach your dog this, given what he does. You put sort of dog-sized blanket down. You teach him to pick up the corner in one mouth, and in one corner in his mouth. He only has one mouth. So he picks up a corner of the blanket in his mouth, and then he does a complete roll. He does roll over. And so he wraps himself up in the blanket and then sits up, and it's the most endearing little thing you've ever seen in your life. And I'll bet you could teach this dog to do it.
Well, I've discovered that he knows many tricks. You know, over the course of the last 2.5 years, he surprises me sometimes with what he's
That's so cute. Well, you know, my guess is that this is literally he is purposely pulling the covers down to get to those nice cool sheets.
Ah.
You know, so many dogs are so hot in our houses so often, and Labs are pretty hardy dogs, and he well might be just pulling it back to those nice cool sheets. So I hope I take him shopping for new sheets with you next time. He might like the silk best.
Oh, I bet he would love that. I don't particularly like dog hair in my bed.
Yeah, I sympathize. I don't either.
Oh, thanks, Lola.
Okay, thank you. I
appreciate the call very much. Well, that's a great story. And whatever Lola wants, Lola doesn't always get. She's not going to have the dog put the bed covers back. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, hear about the experiences you might encounter if you decide to explore all 7 continents. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this week we welcome Marty Essen to the program. Marty's the author of a new book called Cool Creatures, Hot Planet, Exploring the 7 Continents, and it chronicles his and his wife's 8-trip, 3.5-year adventure to some of the wildest places on the planet. And he joins us today to talk about it. Marty Essen, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tricia and Larry.
Why did you decide to do this?
Well, you know, when I reached 39 years old, first of all, I run a business out here in western Montana. And when I moved out here, I worked and worked, never took any vacations. I hit 39 years old and kind of had this midlife crisis where I was doing okay, but, you know, I wasn't having any fun. So my wife and I, what we decided to do is go to visit Belize. I love exploring the rainforest. My wife loves to scuba dive. It was a great place to do that. And one of the things I've always wanted to do since I was about 8 years old is visit the Amazon jungle. And so we decided we'd go do that. And just before we were leaving, one of the local newspapers here in western Montana found out that I was going to go down there. And they asked, well, will you write a story about it? So we went down to the Amazon, had this wonderful time. I wrote a story that ended up in 2 different newspapers in Montana. And I literally had people coming up to me on the street or in restaurants and say, wow, we love that story. Are you going to write another one? And my wife had always wanted to go to Australia. So we decided to go to Australia. And at that time, I thought, well, maybe we can do something more with this. And I did a little research, and I found that no one had ever written a book on the concept of travel to all seven continents in search of rare and unusual wildlife. So I took those first two newspaper stories and rewrote them into book format, and we just continued on our travels and did all seven continents in a period of 3.5 years.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. Amazing.
Wow. I'm inspired. I want to go somewhere right now. And, you know, you talked about the Amazon. I know you went to Africa, but I know you went to Antarctica. What was the most surprising thing you found as you sort of set foot on this huge continent?
One of the rules we had when we got down there, strict rules, were that we had to stay 15 feet away from all the animals so we wouldn't spook them. Well, when we got there, we found out, well, the animals aren't spooked by us, and they work on their own rules. So the animals would approach us, mostly penguins. We'd walk on shore. We'd get off our boat, and we'd go to shore on these rubber rafts called Zodiacs. And these penguins, mostly Gentoo penguins, would come up to us, and the chicks especially would come. They'd pull on our shoelaces, they would pull on pant legs, and if we walked away, they'd follow us as if we were mom. And it was just so much fun watching all these penguins. And then you had all the other animals down there. We had leopard seals, we had elephant seals, fur seals, and the humpback whales, which were just amazing. So all the wildlife down there was just incredible.
Well, I remember reading in your book that you mentioned to one of the guides that you wanted to find a fer-de-lance, which is one of the most poisonous snakes. I'm wondering,
Marty,
why would you want to do that? And first, why are you so interested in snakes? That comes through in many of the chapters.
Well, I'm interested in all animals, but I guess my interest in snakes came when I was a kid. I was about 8 years old, and I was living in Fort Collins, Colorado at the time, and I had a friend whose father was a zoologist. And down in his basement, he had all these different cool creatures. They had Gila monsters. They had venomous snakes and lizards and all these things. And we weren't supposed to go down in the basement. But, of course, tell an 8-year-old where you're not supposed to go, of course, that's where we went. And so we would go down there. We'd look at all these cool creatures. And that's really where I got my love of these type of creatures. You know, the animals that aren't necessarily warm and cuddly. And so going down to the Amazon, it made it more of an adventure. As if you need something to make the Amazon more of an adventure. But to go down and find the deadliest snake in the Western Hemisphere, and that's the fer-de-lance, it's not necessarily the most venomous. There are snakes down there that are more venomous. But what makes this snake so deadly is their camouflage. The rainforest floor in the Amazon is all leaf litter, dead leaves. And these fer-de-lances have kind of that dead leaf coloring. And what happens is the native people down there very seldom wear shoes. And these fer-de-lances, what they'll do is they'll come near the villages because the villages attract rodents. And the rodents, of course, attract the fer-de-lance because that's what they eat. And people will accidentally step on these snakes. So once they're bit by these snakes, which are incredibly venomous, these people are usually 5, 6, maybe 7, 8 hours away from a doctor and can't make it there in time. So the snake is not necessarily an aggressive snake or trying to become the most deadly snake in the Western Hemisphere. It's really happened by accident. People stepping on it and the snake doing what comes naturally, defending itself.
You mentioned that in your travels, you discovered that some of the things that people think are true about animals actually turn out not to be. I would love to hear you talk about some of the myths that you would like to debunk about some of the animals out there.
Well, two in Borneo come to mind. One is elephants in Borneo. We saw elephants in the rainforest, which is something that just seemed really strange to me, to see these elephants in the rainforest. I'm kind of programmed to expect to see elephants on the plains or in the bush of Africa. And after we had this experience with getting charged by elephants in Borneo, Stephen again said to me, he said, you know, one of the prevailing opinions is that elephants were introduced to Borneo in the 1700s by the Sultan of Sulu. And again, you look in books and you're going to see that. And he said, well, my family history, my oral family history goes back much, much farther than the 1700s. And the elephant has always been a part of our history. And it was interesting is when I got back, and part of my writing process is I would do a lot of research when I would go, before I would go to visit a continent. And then when I would come back, I would have to do a lot more research to research the things that I had seen. And as I was doing research, writing my Asia chapter, which is Borneo, I found out that the University of Columbia had recently done DNA tests. And their DNA tests proved that Stephen was right. The elephants are indigenous to Borneo.
That's great.
Yeah, so it was interesting that, you know, the family history could be that accurate going way back, the oral family histories.
Tell us, we know that baboons will dine on impalas, especially the young, and that's one reason they follow impalas around. But there's also a relationship that's, in a way, mutually beneficial to baboons and impalas. And could you talk about that?
Well, yeah, it's something I notice in Africa is that the impalas and baboons were always together. And it seemed to me that they had the symbiotic relationship where the impalas would let the baboons know if there was any danger. And the other thing that the baboons would do is they would be up in the trees eating things, and they'd end up dropping things, and the impalas would be able to come underneath and eat whatever they were dropping. So it was this great relationship between the impalas and the baboons.
I find myself wondering how or if this journey has affected the way you view the wildlife of the planet now.
Well, I guess it's just a better understanding of the wildlife and just a more of appreciation for, you know, how certain animals may be in danger because of things that humans do and why it's so important to protect animals. An example would be vampire bats in Belize. My wife and I walked into this cave filled with vampire bats. And of course, the first things humans would say is, or a lot of humans would say is, ooh, vampire bats. And when humans move into vampire bat territory, what they will do a lot of times is wipe out the bats. And but you never know with some of these animals. We may not know it yet, but they may contain some sort of cure that could be helpful to humans. So even if you can't look at it as we need to protect these animals, we shouldn't kill them off just for the sake of not killing them off, if you look at them from purely a selfish point of view, they can be very valuable. And the vampire bat is a great example. When a vampire bat feeds, what they do is they'll bite an animal. And then they don't suck the blood, but what they do is they lap the blood up. And to get an animal to bleed, they need to have a very effective anticoagulant in their saliva. And in fact, vampire bats have the most effective anticoagulant known to man in their saliva. And scientists have been able to take that and turn it into a drug called Draculin. And this drug, it's a great name, isn't it?
That's great.
And this drug can now be given to people who have had heart attacks or strokes. So this little animal that people might want to eradicate is a lifesaver. There's also a venomous snake down in Brazil where scientists have been able to take that venom and turn it into a drug for people with high blood pressure and with diabetes. And so you see that all over the world, be it rainforest plants. When we were in Borneo, we were with a member of the Ban tribe, and he was telling us about a tree that has recently been protected by Malaysia because they think this tree may contain a cure for AIDS. So there's all these different things throughout the rainforest regions or any region that a lot of these things need to be studied further. And so it's important to protect all these things. We don't know what future cures there are going to be.
You had really some exciting times. We have just begun to scratch the surface of some of them. I recall your story about a hippo taking a bite out of your canoe and throwing you and your wife 6 feet into the air, which had to be quite an experience. Would you ever do this again?
Would I ever do this? Oh, of course I would. Everything we did, I had so much fun. When writing a nonfiction book like this, where you're going as you're writing as you're going, one of my biggest fears was that we would visit a continent and have a boring trip. You know, something nothing exciting happened. But that's not the case. Every single trip we did, something magical happened.
And I tell you what, you had a wonderful experience on all seven continents from the look of your book. And I really want to thank you, Marty. Both of us want to thank you for being with us today. It was a real pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Marty Essen is the author of Cool Creatures, Hot Planet, Exploring the Seven Continents. He joined us today from the studios of KUFM in Missoula, Montana. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Cool Creatures, Hot Planet. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. Now, if you think you know the answer to this week's question, we hope you'll call in. Number is 1-800-462-7413. And all correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and three winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Cool Creatures, Hot Planet by Marty Essen. And here's today's question. In his book, Marty Essen talks about a discussion that developed between him and other passengers on the ship that brought them to the coast of Antarctica. They discussed what the correct term for a group of penguins is. One group of women called it a school of penguins. Others wondered if it should be called a gaggle or a pod of penguins. Eventually, everyone settled on a more interesting term called penguimonium. I love that. Unfortunately, though, when Marty returned to the U.S., the encyclopedia did not list penguimonium as the proper term for a group of penguins.
Well, it should have.
Should have. I love it. What do you call a group of penguins anyway? That's the question. And if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the correct answer, check our website. In about a week, we'll have it posted online at callingallpets.org. And now let's talk to a listener. Here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Mary from Pickett, Wisconsin.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is my friend's cat. At some point, the cat decided that outside looked good, so it ripped a hole in the screen and became an indoor-outdoor cat, because if she fixed the screen, it would simply rip a hole in a different screen and just continue. So where the problem arises is that this spring, the cat decided that the middle of the night was a good time to bring in a live bunny, and the other cat would get involved. There are three small dogs the size of your terriers that would all get involved. There are three children. The youngest is 11, and the children all got involved, and everyone's involved in the chase.
This is like a television sitcom.
It's more than you want to have in your home. So
yeah,
she,
yeah.
You know, considered declawing the cat. That was where I bristled, going, well, I believe strongly that wasn't a solution to the problem. What suggestions do you have about altering the behavior of having them bring it in to you, especially live? And also, if we could talk perhaps about other problems that declawing creates. I guess I feel that it just introduces new behavior that still is not desirable, and maybe you could help with more insight about that when I'm trying to be concerned about the cat, but also about the people and the family that it
okay.
That own it.
A lot of issues to talk about here. So let's address them one at a time. Regrettably, first of all, the bad news is that I know of no way that you can prevent an animal who is allowed to go in and out from coming in with anything they can get in through a hole that's large enough to allow them to get through it. I mean, I suppose one possibility, although I think, frankly, this is not a good alternative, is to make the hole really, really tiny, such that the cat can only get the cat itself inside. But the fact of the matter is that if an animal can go out, then they can come in, and cats are nocturnal hunters. That's what cats do outside. So frankly, this is not an elegant solution, and it might not be a welcome one, but I would suggest not letting the cat outside at night. A lot of mammals come out at night, and a lot of animals are more vulnerable to predation at night. Now, certainly there are a lot of nesting birds who are vulnerable to cats. So, you know, this is a big issue for wildlife ecologists, with a lot of concerns about cats preying, you know, domestic or semi-domesticated animals preying on wildlife. So that would frankly be the simplest solution. Now, related to the declawing, first of all, I want to support your belief. I, too, share a belief that it's best to avoid declawing cats if we possibly can. The traditional sort of old surgery is such a radical surgery. It's basically taking the last joint of four toes of the forepaws off, and it's a big surgery. It's an amputation, basically. It's eight separate amputations. My favorite solution is just to leave the claws there, teach the cat to have them trimmed, and to get some really good scratching posts. I think that's the best solution. I should say the cat that I have now, Sushi, who came from a shelter, was found as a stray. She had been declawed, and I'm happy to say she's one of the cats that doesn't have any behavioral problems related to that. But I completely concur with you that if we can avoid that, I think that's a good thing.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Mary. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Mark from Milwaukee.
Mark from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Good to have you with us. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about our cat who is about 8 years old. He has this behavior where he continually chases his tail.
Ooh.
And he'll chase it and snap at it. And so when we get up to distract him, he stops chasing his tail and he runs immediately to his food dish. So I'm wondering if there's something we can do to train him from doing that and starting him to do something else instead.
Let me ask you a question, Mark. Does he, when he's chasing his tail, does he start, there's actually a syndrome in which cats start growling and attacking their own tail. Does he, when you say he bites at it, does this look playful or does he look serious? Is he like attacking his tail or just?
He looks pretty serious. And, yeah. And in fact, he snaps at it. So he's caught it once or twice, and when he catches it, he does bite it.
It's just such an interesting issue. We do not understand exactly what's going on, but it seems to be some kind of a misfiring. I've seen a video of a cat who looked at his tail as if a monster appeared. They don't seem to know it's attached to them, and they actually, is that what it feels like?
That's what it looks like, exactly. It almost looks like he goes through periods where he doesn't recognize his own tail.
Yeah. It's not uncommon. The video I saw, the cat was extremely aggressive and was injuring himself. But at lower levels of intensity of the problem, it's possible that you can turn this around with conditioning, with using some kind of operant conditioning, such that what I would try is, first of all, observe the cat like you're Jane Goodall. Just be really, really thoughtful. You might even want to video it. What you're looking for is a precursor to the actual sort of targeting on the tail, so you can get really good at predicting about when the cat is about to do it. And when the cat is about to do it, I want you to make some kind of a sound that basically acts as an interruption. So the idea is going to be interrupt and redirect. Sort of startle the cat, don't scare it, don't punish it, but startle it such that it stops doing what it's doing, turns and orients towards you, and then you redirect the cat to do something else.
Okay. Is there something we should redirect him to do? It's just something he enjoys?
Well, it probably depends on the cat. You might want to try play. If he likes to play, is he a playful cat?
He definitely is.
Good. I would try, first of all, you might want to just condition a sound. You might even want to teach him, if you go like that, just make a little tongue click, and then give him a piece of his favorite food, a little tiny little piece of his favorite food, such that you teach him to turn and look at you when you go. So when he starts, you think it's like, oh, he's going to do it. You go. He turns and looks at you, and you can either give him a piece of food or get a great toy on a fishing pole kind of like setup and get him playing with it. And if you can get him out of the habit, you might be able to get him out of it without having to talk about medication.
Oh, great.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Mark, for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Patricia, let's take an email question now from Elizabeth in Evansville, Wisconsin. Here's what she writes. She says, Patricia, you once advised a caller who was asking about the impact of moving to a new house that, as a general rule, dogs are loyal to people and cats are loyal to places. And I'm really curious to know more about why this would be. Aside from a situation when moving with one's cats is not an option, are there exceptions to this rule? Can you say anything about the nature of a cat's level of attachment to its owner? And compare that with a dog's.
Well, it's a really good set of questions. And there's no question cats are highly variable. You know, I've always said that cats don't read the books. And so there's always a cat out there who's quick to prove you wrong when you make some generalizations. And it is absolutely true that there are some cats that are extremely bonded to one particular individual, sometimes so much so that it becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, they won't let visitors into the house or they're jealous of the new boyfriend or something like that. So it's not that cats don't ever form social bonds. I was extremely close to one of my former cats, Ayla, who I wrote about in one of my books, and she seemed to be very, very bonded to me as well. So it's not that cats can't, as individuals, form social bonds. They certainly can. But if you look at the big picture, you know, if you take 1,000 cats and 1,000 dogs, you're going to get a much higher number of dogs whose main motivation in life is to hang out with their person, you know, and you're going to get a smaller number of cats. And if you look at the natural history of both species, it makes all the sense in the world. You know, dogs' closest relatives are wolves. There, you know, there's a beautiful saying, is that I think it's the heart of a wolf is the pack and the heart of the pack is the wolf. I mean, they're just, mm-hmm. they're so highly social. And cats have this what's called facultatively social system in which if there are a lot of resources around, they can hang out together, especially the females like to have their young together, and then one can protect the young from male cats, by the way, mm-hmm. while the others go off hunting. But they hunt alone. They're solitary hunters, and they're also quite fine, many of them in the wild, on their own. Obviously, they're individual domestic cats or household cats who are not fine on their own, thank you very much. But so it's a big generalization, and I'm sure probably the person who wrote in has a cat who's like her Labrador in cat disguise, because it does happen.
Thanks very much for that question, by the way, and for people to email us.
Oh, we'd love questions to hear from you. Yeah, send us ideas or questions to pets@wpr.org.
And thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Patricia. We'll be back next week. We'll do this again.
We will. You guys are stuck with us. We're here every week.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0308P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
This week on Calling All Pets, find out if certain dog breeds become more popular after a win at the Westminster Dog Show.
And train your dog to become a pet detective who helps lost animals reunite with their families.
Tune in for that and more of your calls on the very next Calling All Pets.